It is a privilege to be here today, passing on the teachings of my great teacher, Shunyu Suzuki Roshi, and by giving meaning to his teachings, giving meaning to the practice of all of the great Buddhist ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. Dharma for the people. That was the lifelong personal vow of Kodo Suwaki Roshi. Dharma for the people. Dharma for the people. He sought to make the teachings which do not follow ordinary logic and can be very difficult to penetrate, simple enough so anyone can understand. And he had a real gift, not only for the teaching, but for this exquisite boiling down that he was able to do amazingly. He made Zen Buddhism popular. So today, instead of a chronology, I would like to give you some vignettes. First, of how he practiced. Second, of a relationship with a close disciple that really shows compassion and tenderness in him. And also a snapshot of his work in the field. From these, you'll get, I think, a fair impression of who he was Zen-wise, and also how he wandered into making a huge imprint on the world. So how did he practice? First of all, he asked permission to do a solo retreat in a dilapidated, abandoned branch temple that was watched over by an old teacher. Roshi says, it was the perfect place for me. Here I would spend all my time practicing Zazen. And all my time meant from 2 in the morning till 10 at night. He ate rice and pickles, and he did this for 3 years. So when Kodo Suwaki Roshi says all Buddhism is but a footnote to Zazen, he certainly knows what he's talking about. One very moving story that shows how he was kind of a macho type guy, but he was also very tender and very compassionate. And he had a disciple named Akiko Takada. And his biographer got this story from a man named Kokuo, K-O-K-U-O, Kokuo, who also became a disciple of Suwaki during this period. So Kokuo was a teacher at an elementary school in Amakusa and would visit Suwaki during his school holidays. Probably he came and sat sesshins. And one winter, the winter of 1919, Kokuo entered his teacher's room and a woman of 27 or 28 came in with a tray of tea and sweets. In Kokuo's words, she was a small woman, dignified looking and beautiful. She was dressed in the appropriate Japanese dress and her skin was extremely pale. Suwaki introduced Kokuo to Akiko. "This is my disciple, Kokuo. We shared rice when I studied with Reverend Koho at Soshinji Monastery." Shared rice, that it's just an expression that means they practice together. But he's also being modest. It's not like they sat next to each other in the Zendo. I think he had a position there. But anyway, so they shared rice when he was at Soshinji Monastery. And Kokuo, who was treated as a guest that day, this is at a temple called Daijiji, which was Suwaki's temple when he wasn't traveling. So at dinner, Kokuo found himself sitting opposite Akiko, and they recited the five prayers before meals and had a nourishing, though thrifty, Zen main course, and finished with tea. And according to Kokuo's diary, he asked her in his direct Zen fashion, "You are young and are practicing in rather intimate circumstances with these young, vibrant monks on a daily basis. As a woman, are you aware that you are with the opposite sex?" Oh my God. To me, that's like a dumb question. But anyway, she responded without a moment's hesitation, "Of course I'm aware." Kokuo felt as if he were on the top of a peak and had fallen on his face. "How do you deal with that feeling?" he asked. Notice the projection. He's projecting onto her his own feelings of not being entirely in control of himself when he has to deal with a young, beautiful woman in a space where direct sexual feelings usually are not an issue. So he asks her how she deals with it. And though it would be a rude question in other circumstances, it was not considered rude in a Zen context. "Clouds come and go with no mind. With me, thoughts flow accordingly. At some point, they disappear without my being aware," she replied without missing a beat. So in his 30 years of traveling and meeting many different people, he had never met anyone like her. He nodded, bowed to her, and went back to Sawaki's room. "Well, how was it? Did you have a feast?" Sawaki asked, curiosity reflected in his expression. "I met her and had quite a feast. I'm referring to her response to my questions. She wasn't parroting anything she learned. I just had a Zen encounter with a very special person. Tell me about this woman." And so Sawaki proceeded to tell Kokuo about her. "That's Akiko Takada. She comes from a pretty wealthy merchant family in Osaka. After graduating from a girls' high school, she was stricken with spinal caries and was treated at Tsugayama Hospital. At that time, her younger sister had just gotten married and visited her in the hospital dressed in her best clothes. Akiko felt a wave of loneliness because of her misfortune with her diseased body and started to move her heart toward Christ and the Buddha." Sawaki then continued to tell Akiko's story. "At first, she met with a Christian missionary. She listened to him and she read the Bible, but it didn't satisfy her or help her with her spiritual crisis. Then she heard about Nantembo Nakahara, a well-known Zen master whose intense approach to Zen was talked about throughout the country. He was a Rinzai teacher who resided at Kaiseiji Temple in Nishinomiya. Akiko attended his lectures and began to practice Zazen. But here too, there was something about the practice that didn't settle her spiritual agony, and also the physical suffering she felt continued. Sawaki used to give lectures and conduct Zazen practice meetings at an Obaku sect temple near Akiko's home. So he was giving teachings right in her neighborhood. It's so typical of him. When she heard about the meeting, she decided to attend the lecture while sitting way in the back. Sawaki was lecturing on Keizan Zenji's Zazen Yojinki, which translates a record of points to watch in Zazen. She received the text that Sawaki printed free of charge for his attendees. To Akiko, Sawaki looked like an arhat. that is one who has attained nirvana. And his voice seemed to come deep down in his hara, his lower abdomen. She felt that he spoke with an openness that came from the depth of his reality, and it reverberated to the depth of her own. And by the way, he spent a lot of personal money to print and distribute the text of every talk he gave, he, an impoverished itinerant monk, but he wanted seekers of the Dharma to be sure to receive the Dharma. It's a small point, but it's really important, I think. So Aikiko decided then and there to follow Sawaki and asked his permission to go with him to Daijiji. The objections of her family, of course, did no good. Once she made up her mind, she was determined. Daijiji continued its severe practice schedule, and Aikiko followed it. I think he was already doing his five-day, all-day zazen and nothing else, sesshins, once a month. So she practiced with the monks and kept up with them, never shrinking from any of the required activities. In fact, she worked harder than many of them. And in addition, she attended sesshins at branch temples, following all the rules of practice. And this was at a time when allowing women to practice formally with the monks was a very big deal. Aikiko had gone to Daijiji in November 1918 and returned to Osaka for the new year of 1920. Sawaki said he didn't know whether it was the power of spiritual practice or the divine intervention of the Buddhas and patriarchs, but her health had improved considerably. Tadao Tanaka, Sawaki's biographer, wrote an article from a newspaper inserted in Kukuo's notebook that announced Akiko's death and talked about her practicing under Kodo Sawaki. When Sawaki went to Osaka to conduct retreats, Aikiko always attended them. The article said that at one of the retreats, an influenza epidemic spread and Aikiko caught it. But the article said that Tanaka, however, said that was a mistake. Her spinal caries was the reason for her death. And when Sawaki heard about her illness returning, he went to her house. And though she was not to receive visitors, when she heard it was her teacher, she rushed to greet him. He quietly returned with her to her bedside and sat beside her. "How are you?" he said. She smiled faintly through her emaciated face. "I am practicing for my death," she said, and put her hands in prayer pose. "I have one request. This is the last time we will meet in this world. Can you bestow on me the three refuges?" Sawaki immediately put his hands together and said, "Repeat after me. I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dharma. I take refuge in the Sangha." When Aikiko finished repeating after him, she continued sitting on her bed and quietly stopped breathing. That means she attained, she was enlightened. That's how the great ones die. They're seated in full lotus and they quietly stop breathing. Sometimes they remain sitting in full lotus for several days or more, and even weeks, several weeks. And I just want to make this point. When she asked her teacher to bestow on her the three refuges, basically, we don't talk about in this language is not the Zen language, but actually what's going on is she's asking for an empowerment. In the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, most practices cannot be done without an empowerment. It's like the master unlocks the spiritual power from the ritual so that it can enter you. Without the empowerment, the ritual is empty. This is also true for statues, by the way, that you may have. If they're blessed by a Rinpoche and filled with blessed jewels, which is called being consecrated. So if your statues are consecrated, they convey infinitely more spiritual power. One can feel it in the room. She could just have said the refuge prayer just herself, but she asked him to bestow it on her. This is very important. So that was the second thing, the vignette I kind of wanted to give you. And the last one is a patron donated his second house on Mainichi-zan, which is a mountain near Kumamoto Station, for Sawaki to live and continue to develop his practice. It was the genesis of a life on the road in response to invitations to conduct sesshins, give Dharma talks at temples, homes, and lectures and lecture halls, turning his always bubbling energy into an asset that would give him the epithet homeless Kodo, probably because he was dressed like an itinerant monk and looked homeless. In this way, he began what he called his moving monastery that lasted for 12 years and was so fitting for him. So he had Daijiji, but he attended the 5-day monthly sesshin, which was just zazen all day, every day. And he also taught at Komazawa University, which was the main Soto Zen university in Japan. But mostly he traveled in response to people asking for him to give sesshin or talks or, anything Dharma related. This is that call and response dynamic that I've mentioned to you before. And it's why asking questions at the end of the talk, for example, is the same thing. You ask questions, basically you're asking to receive the Dharma. You ask a question to receive the Dharma. And in the same way, the great ones, when you ask help, they respond to requests. They don't just come and help you. They respond to requests. So this idea of call and response is very important in Zen. We've mentioned it before, and I just want to stress it here in this situation, because Kodo Sawaki's whole life from here on out in his moving monastery was responding to calls. That was his whole life. So then he says, when I'm at home, which is, sometimes he was at home in between calls, there is usually a group of people who come in the morning to do zazen with me. They gather at 5:30. So I get up at 4, I clean the house, burn incense, and change the flowers on the altar. Then I boil water for tea. By then the group shows up. I don't have help, so I do all the preparation myself. When he was not at home, he was traveling somewhere for teaching. For example, this is an amazing example. For Sawaki, the energy and inquiring minds of students from the 5th high school helped him to develop a teaching style that was personal, and not overly technical. So this is because of them, and I'll tell you about them in a second, he developed a teaching style that was Dharma for the people. That's how he got to Dharma for the people. Dharma that anyone can understand, anyone, and they tested it out. So these students were handpicked to attend one of the top high schools in the country, and they'd eventually enter what's now Tokyo University without taking an entrance exam. They knew that they were special, and they walked around Kumamoto as if they owned the town. Their antics as they pushed their way into wherever they wanted to go was the attitude of a bunch of spoiled brats, really. For many of the citizens of Kumamoto, they were an arrogant group that belonged in a reform school rather than a prestigious high school, like the fifth high school. For Sawaki, however, it was just terrific because they had tons of energy, and it was preferable to students with low energy who made the severe Zen practice that he required impossible. So one day, a secretary from the fifth high school Young Buddhist Club approached Sawaki to ask if he would come and talk with the members. And Kodo agreed, and it was the beginning of a relationship with his students that was both trying and educational beyond his imagination. So he describes the students as walking along the central street of Kumamoto as if they were free from worldly cares, with their high-toothed wooden sandals, a rag-like towel hanging from their back pockets, their hair looking as though it had been through a mountain storm, and their stride as though they owned the streets. One time, a group of the high school boys were mingling in the center of town, and one of them had to urinate. So he did it right in front of a police box, of course. A policeman came out and reprimanded him for his action, and the group started to complain, well, he had to pee, so what can he do? And the policeman got angry and took them all to the police station, and they called the head of their dorm, who called the police captain, and they were all quickly released. It seems that the head of their dorm had a higher position in Kumamoto society than the police captain. It was that sense of their own privilege in town that allowed them to act the way they did. So when Sawaki gave his first talk at the high school, he wore his black robe rolled up to his knees, his umbrella hat, his walking staff, and his sandals. He walked the 18 kilometers at a speedy pace that defined him throughout his life. He arrived with sweat pouring down his face. Probably, these students had never seen a visiting lecturer come looking as little concerned about his dress. They realized from the beginning that they weren't dealing with someone whom they could easily intimidate. And by the way, many people in Kumamoto, according to Sawaki, forgave these high school boys their arrogant behavior, because unlike other school students, they expressed their feelings openly. Japan was entering a period known as the Taisho democracy. It was the beginning of an era when people from a society that was authoritarian, where rules were strictly followed, were now experimenting with individual rights and democratic principles. So for many of the citizens, these students, though sometimes outrageous, were expressing themselves in the way the citizens themselves secretly envied. So I need to say that. Not everybody, well, they thought they were arrogant, but they wished they were able to be arrogant too. And the openness of the students helped open Sawaki to a larger world than the sheltered world of Zen to which he had become accustomed. As he was direct in ways that were new to them, at least for someone who wore a Buddhist robe, it was for Sawaki a work in progress. On his first visit to the school, he opened with a question, "What remains with you boys if we take away your appetite for sex and food. That really grabbed their attention, in Sawaki's words. After that, they listened like submissive puppies, and they followed him around when he gave talks elsewhere, often embarrassing him with their behavior. They didn't show the respect they showed Sawaki to the patrons at the places where he lectured. Though they did respect Sawaki, they didn't allow him to get away with explaining Buddhist theory unless the explanation was clear to them as laymen. When he tried to explain basic Buddhist principles to one of the students, Sawaki said, "I'd spent 2 or 3 hours explaining to Kusaba-kun, I believe it was Kusaba, he says, the basic tenets of Buddhism." The boy listened quietly. "Well," I said, "do you understand?" And he made a sourpuss, cocked his head and said, "I didn't understand anything." It was frustrating for Sawaki, but it also encouraged him to learn to present Buddhist principles in ways that the average person would be able to fathom. It was a quality that made his talks popular with people from all walks of life, a signature of Kodo Sawaki's lectures throughout his career as a Zen teacher. He also came to realize that these high school students didn't particularly want to be spoon-fed. They appreciated a sincere attempt to explain things, as long as the explanations weren't hidden behind arcane Buddhist jargon. They like to be challenged. So, Osho-san, what is the benefit of practicing Zazen? The group asked me one day. "Even if you practice Zazen, it comes to nothing." My response seemed to shock them, and I wondered if it would resonate. "He's a gutsy priest," one of them said. "The pastor from the church would never say anything like that." They grumbled as they returned to school. Then they showed up again. "Osho-san, we've come to practice the Zazen that will bring us no benefit." Well, they got the point. From then on, a group of fifth high school students came to Daijiji to practice Zazen. They kept up with the monks, attending the severe session schedule. Clearly something powerful about Sawaki's no gain Zen appealed to them. And finally, I just want to give you one straight teaching from Sawaki Roshi, and it's very short. And then Okamura Roshi, his grandson, his Dharma grandson, whom we'll hear about in a few weeks, commenting on it. So the teaching from Sawaki: the root source of delusion takes place when we begin to think I. Many people complain, I'm busy. What are they so busy with? They're busy being used by their delusory desires. That's all. The true reality of all things is resolved at peace. There is no need to try to twist things into what we want. And Okamura Roshi's comment, he opens with a quote from Ryokan, based on Dogen Zenji's poem, Original Face. So this is Ryokan's poem. "In spring, the cherry blossoms. In summer, the cuckoo song. In autumn, the moon shining. In winter, the frozen snow. How pure and clear are the seasons." And Okamura Roshi goes on to say that the thing that makes the seasons beautiful throughout the year is the original face of ourselves. Uchiyana Roshi often said that the life force, that Uchiyana Roshi is Sawaki Roshi's Dharma heir and Okamura Roshi's Dharma father, but don't worry about that. But Uttiyana Roshi also said that the life force that enables us to breathe a certain number of times a minute, even while we sleep, that same life force is the power that makes the autumn leaves turn red. So that's why Okumura Roshi said that it is the original face of ourselves. Because he had so few personal possessions, Ryokan said, his keepsake to offer was everything in nature. His poems and his life, and his poems and his life without greed and self-centeredness were his offerings. And Sawaki Roshi's homeless life, without a temple, was the same. While alive, he used his veteran's pension. We talked last week about how he was shot through the tongue in the war, and he got a pension, and he used his pension to print the texts of all of his talks, so that anyone who attended a Dharma talk of Sawaki Roshi received a text of the talk free, because he sponsored it from his pension. And when he died, his body was donated to Kyoto University Hospital, his books to the Komazawa University Library. In the end, his Zazen practice with thousands of people was his offering and legacy. Within our Zazen, he still lives. So here, there are many important points today, but here are a few of them. I'm sort of just grabbing like a grab bag from all of them. The first one, Osho-san, what is the benefit of practicing Zazen? The group asked me one day, even if you practice Zazen, it comes to nothing. No gain Zen is one of Sawaki's main teachings. No gain Zen. Zazen practice comes to nothing. We don't try to get anything out of it. Second, the root source of delusion takes place when we begin to think I. That's the beginning of it. Third, I'm practicing for my death. This is Aikiko. Said and put her hands in the prayer pose. I have one request. This is the last time we will meet in this world. Can you bestow on me the three refuges? And may we all follow her example. And fourth, this wonderful Ryokan poem, in spring the cherry blossoms, in summer the cuckoo song, in autumn, the moon shining, in winter, the frozen snow. How pure and clear are the seasons. And the thing that makes the seasons beautiful throughout the year is the original face of ourselves. And fifth, what remains with you boys if we take away your appetite for sex and food? And we can all ask ourselves the same or a slightly different version of that question. Those things that we are overly attached to, or at least very, very attached to. This question cuts to the chase. It really requires separating ourselves out from things that we kind of perseverate about, to say the least. We all do it. So here are some ideas for reflections during the week. First, he practiced from 2 a.m. till 10 p.m. He ate rice and pickles and stayed for 3 years. When you hear these words, what do you feel? Even if you can't do it, can you take inspiration from the power and wisdom that drove it? So to just stay with those words and rest with them and see what happens for you. We're not expected to do that practice, but it would be interesting to know when we hear that he did it, what happens inside of us. Second, clouds come and go with no mind. With me, thoughts flow accordingly. At some point, they disappear without my being aware. Her story is so powerful and her words are so profound, but can you state why? What truth is she touching on? It's a big truth, and she's definitely touching on it. And third, even if you practice Zazen, it comes to nothing. What is your feeling about this teaching? We all have a different feeling. What does that teaching do inside of you? Fourth, because he had so few possessions, Ryokan said his keepsake to offer was everything in nature. I offer that tree. I offer that field of flowers. His poem and his life without greed and self-centeredness were his offerings. And so how does this example serve as a teaching for you? What exactly? You don't have to stay with the obvious. What exactly is a teaching for you in that gesture, final gesture of Ryokan's? And fifth, Dharma for the people. But the important point, that which Suwaki Roshi's personal vow, and you can see it all the way across his life, Dharma for the people, Dharma for the people. How can I make this understood by literally anyone? But the important point for us about Suwaki Roshi is not so much what his vow was, but how diligently and continuously he practiced it for the duration of his life. What are the things in your life that you practice diligently and continuously? Will they be part of your personal vow? I wonder if there are questions.
Thank you, Gail. There is a first comment. I practice several things diligently and continuously, but they're not activities that reveal a personal life vow to me. For example, I take walks every day and I try to do one thoughtful thing for someone else. These are good things to do, but really don't say anything about who I am. Not enough for a personal vow. I'm having a hard time getting to the heart of this.
Thank you. It's good. It's good you bring it up. And what comes to my mind is the very first question on the 10 question list. Who am I? And then from there, the subsidiary questions, like asking you about your childhood fantasies of, well, when I grow up, I'm going to, and even your teenage ideas about, I'm going to be such and such. And, you know, we get squelched. We get out of our early teenage years, and suddenly all these big worldly things come and hit us, and we change. And sometimes we lose, something else becomes very important, you know, money or power or stature in the society. And we forget, you know, oh, I wanted to be a nurse, remember? I was so passionate about that when I was 13. So things like that is what I would point you to. You know, Homeless Kodo was really one of a kind. We don't have any other Homeless Kodos. And how are you one of a kind? In what ways are you one of a kind? We're all one of a kind in some way. So you can maybe answer that question instead. How am I one of a kind? Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. So another one that we have is, in some weird way, it does help to think of Zazen as good for nothing. Otherwise, I put a lot of stock in it. And when those things don't turn out, I start losing interest. To do something just for the sake of doing it and not looking for anything else. Accolades, pats on the back, progress, approval is a relief and lets things just be. I'm glad about it.
I know. It's like one thing in our life that's set aside where we don't just put our whole baggage on it. Also, it requires us to make what we do into a practice. So it's really easy not to do this. People forget all the time to make what they do into a practice instead of just, well, I'm going to gain this. And in a year, my New Year's resolution is next January 1st, I'm going to have accomplished X, Y, and Z. That's my goal. But when we have a practice, we don't accomplish anything necessarily. We just vow to day after day, make our best effort to do whatever it is. So whatever your, let's say the thing that makes you, like Suwaki Roshi with Homeless Kodo, the thing that makes you one of a kind, I'm going to practice doing that every single day so that I get saturated with the depth of what that's about. And we also have more agency this way. We can control if we, not control, that's a bad word, but we can assess whether our effort is wholehearted or half-hearted or barely visible. and then simply do our best and accept that what we do our, that what we've said is our best is our best. A lot of people don't know what their best is, and they're always criticizing themselves. Well, I didn't really do my best. But if you practice making things into a practice and then doing your best day in and day out, you will get to know what your best is. That's a side benefit. So that's my answer. I agree with you that it's kind of a relief. And also it has this other benefit of encouraging us to make whatever we do into a practice. I brush my teeth every night before I go to bed, whatever it is, that's your practice. Thank you.
Thank you, Gil. So someone shared, this is about Akiko, his disciple. To me, there is a connection energy-wise between Sawaki's solo retreat, for example, sitting for 3 years from 2 a.m. to 10 p.m., and Akiko's not hesitating to pursue each and every opportunity she had for sitting Zazen intensively. Even going to other temples for Sashin, though she already practiced at a place with the heavy Zazen, an even heavier Sashin schedule, she sure had the right spirit for a disciple of Sawaki Roshi, just noticing.
Yeah, I know. It is amazing. She is, but also notice that she was able to leave her body in the lotus posture as she moved on to wherever she was going. Also, don't forget what chutzpah it took for Kodo Sawaki to bring her in to a zendo of, you know, to do that kind of practice, you need really macho men. And to bring her in to a zendo of those kind of men without flinching, he didn't even bat an eye. He just did it and let them take responsibility for their own practice. And actually that's part of the tradition. His legacy is also like that, that you're responsible for your own practice. The teacher doesn't kind of look, oh, were you with Zazen this morning? Or, you know, it's not like that. You do what you do. You're responsible for what you do. And remembering that Zazen and enlightenment are the same, you avail yourself of these opportunities whenever you can. She reminds me of Trudy Dixon that Suzuki Roshi had, who also had cancer and died and attained enlightenment before she died. And whatever that means, I don't really know what that means. But Suzuki Roshi said, I never expected to have a disciple like this. So probably Sawaki Roshi felt the same. And everyone is affected. It's really a moment. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. This is just a technical question, but I don't quite understand. Sawaki Roshi taught at a university for 30 years, and he had a temple where he sometimes stayed. I see a wandering monk who begs for his meals, but I don't see the professor, scholar, nor the abbot. How does this work?
I kind of had the same question. I just wondered how it works because he taught at Komazawa University for 30 years. And I'm sure he had classes scheduled. So, and then he also had this 5-day sesshin that he taught. or sad every month. He probably just organized it in such a way where that part of the month he wasn't able to travel. That's what I guess. I've never read anything about the actual workings of it. I do know that when he was at the university, he slept in the dorms. And of course at his monastery, he had his abbot's quarters. And on the road, he had whatever provisions his host provided for him. He didn't really make money doing this at all. I think actually he probably lost money. He used his pension to provide these texts of the talk, and he was given money for travel, like whatever travel expense he had, or and food and shelter. Like he probably was staying with whoever invited him, but they didn't give him money that I know of. I don't think he made any money from these teaching, leading sessions, leading retreats. Now teachers make a stipend. Sometimes it's quite a bit. Anyway, I also don't really know how he worked it out. And I don't think he was paid. That's all.
Thank you, Gail. So the last question so far that we have is, we are busy being used by our delusory desires. What does delusory desires mean?
It means exactly the answer that Aikiko gave to the man who said, are you aware that you're surrounded by men? Clouds come and go with no mind. With me, thoughts flow accordingly. At some point, they disappear without my being aware. Clouds come and go with no mind. With me, thoughts come and go with no mind, just like the clouds. And at some point, they disappear, and I'm not even thinking about them. That's delusory desires. That's the same as, I wish I had such and such. Thoughts like that come and go with no mind. They flow on accordingly, and eventually we forgot we even thought that. And the delusory part is unconscious. And the problem with all of that is the unconscious part. She's totally conscious of what's going on with her. But if we're unconscious, it turns into karma, and our karma can be a troublemaker for us. So delusory basically means unconscious and off point and possibly dangerous. And our desires are often unconscious, off point, and possibly dangerous. So that's what delusory desires mean. And they really turn our heads away from what we should be thinking of. You know, I think that's maybe the biggest danger. I'm sure there are a lot of dangers here, but one of the biggest dangers, let's say, is it's yanking our heads off into this stream of thoughts about whatever desire it is, and it can go on for days, and you forget what you were intending to X, Y, and Z, and you haven't even done it or thought about it. That's the danger of delusory desire. I think that's all I have to say. I'm sorry. I think we're almost out of time. Is there a last short question?
No, Gail, that was the last one. We don't have any other.
All right, well then I am going to, as always, thank you, Sahar, and Brian, and Brendan, for the tremendous work, a tremendous amount of work done behind the scenes to make these talks possible. I'm so grateful. And I hope I'll see you next week. Bye-bye.